On. All right. Wonderful. So, I don't know if any of you know about, there's a British comedian and outspoken atheist whose name is Ricky Gervais. And if you've ever seen anything by him, he can be quite funny at times. He wrote this, he produced this movie called The Invention of Lying, and it was a comedy movie. It's quite entertaining. There's this guy who lives in a world. Well, Ricky Gervais actually plays the main character, and it's a guy who lives in a world in which nobody knows about lying or how to lie. Everybody always and only ever tells the truth, and the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. And so he lives in this world. And he's a bit of his life is a bit of a mess. He doesn't really have much going for him, and he's chronically broke. And one day he goes to the, he has lots of bills to pay, and he can't afford to pay them. And he goes to the bank one day, and he asks to draw, I think it's like it's $100 from the bank, and the teller says, "Oh, I think there's a mistake because the system tells me that you've got 0 money in your bank account." And then all of a sudden, an idea pops into his head. "What if I lied?" And he says, "Oh, are you sure? Because I'm sure I had $2,000 in my account." And the bank teller says, "I'm so sorry, sir. Here is your money. I'll get that fixed right away." And so it's like he's now developed this new superpower that he can lie. And then what happens later on in the story is his mom is, I think, dying from cancer or something like that. And he's talking to his mom, and he cares for his mom, and his mom is explaining how afraid she is of dying, and what is going to happen, you know, when she dies, and like, what, you know, is this all there is to life? And it's terrifying and it's scary, and so then what he does is he tells a lie to her, and he says, "Don't worry, mom. Don't worry, there is this incredible place. There's this incredible place after you die that you will go to be with. You will go to be with God, and it's going to be beautiful and wonderful, and it's going to be like nothing you've ever experienced before. And you'll be happy. There'll be no more death or crying or pain. You know, it'll just be wonderful. So you don't have to be afraid of death." And so he makes up this lie to comfort her. And so obviously the premise of the movie is Ricky Gervais is saying, well, that's basically what religion is. It's wishful thinking. It's that we struggle to deal with the realities and the harshness and the cruelty of life, and so we make up a belief in God. We make up a belief in the afterlife. And so this morning as you might know, we're working through the first 6 questions in the Westminster Catechism, and last time we looked at the meaning of life. What is the meaning of life? And today we're looking at the second question, which is there we go. The second question, and this is of the larger catechism, so that's the director's cut, the extended edition of the shorter catechism. So, how does it appear that there is a God? And so the question we're asking is, how do we know that there is a God? Like, are we just making this up? Is it just wishful thinking? Or can we actually know that God really exists? And so the answer the Catechism gives us, the very light of nature in man and the works of God declare plainly that there is a God, but his word and spirit only do sufficiently and effectually reveal him unto men for their salvation. So that answer is really what Romans chapter 1 is teaching. It really, that's a summary of Romans 1. And that's what we're going to be looking at this morning. And so there's really kind of three things that Paul teaches us. Sorry, four things that Paul teaches us in our passage. One, Paul shows us how we can know that God exists. Paul shows us that why we do actually know God, and why we choose not to know God, and how we can truly know him. So it's kind of paradoxical. We do know there is a God, but we also don't know, but we can know him. So we'll jump into that. So that first point there, how can we know that God exists? How is that possible? Like, can we actually know that God really exists? Are we just guessing? Have a look at verse 19, what Paul says, or the end of verse 19. Paul says that God has made it plain to them, for since the creation of the world, God's invisible qualities, his eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly seen, being understood from what has been made, so that men are without excuse. And so Paul says, yes, we can absolutely know whether God exists. If you look at nature, if you look at the created world, there is lots of evidence for the existence of God. There, he says, his eternal power, his divine nature have been clearly seen. And so many Christians have come to this verse and interpreted here what Paul is doing here, as he's referring here to the traditional arguments for the existence of God. And they're very old. They go all the way back, even before Christianity. Aristotle, for instance, was one of the guys who developed arguments for the existence of God. And Christians even picked up Aristotle's arguments and worked on them some more and developed them some more. And it's a big study in the area of philosophy. One of those arguments, some of the traditional arguments are the cosmological. Those are like the two big ones, the cosmological and the teleological, or fine-tuning arguments, right? So the cosmological argument was what Aristotle kind of came up with. And basically what Aristotle said is, if everything, remember how I explained a few weeks back that in Greek philosophy, that the Greek philosophers looked at the world and they saw that there seems to be a design, there seems to be a purpose behind everything. Everything works together in a very structured and ordered way. And they said, well, that was the Logos. Well, Aristotle said that, like, we can actually deduce that there must be a God, because if everything has order and structure, if there's everything that happens has a cause, then if you work your way back and you say, well, okay, if you look at anything in the universe and you say, okay, well, what caused that? And then you go back and you say, well, what caused that? What caused that? What caused that? Eventually, you have to get back to a point where there needs to be an uncaused cause. There has to be something that actually is not itself caused that actually brought everything into being. That's the cosmological argument. It's really, today, it's known as Big Bang Theory. Anyone seen that show? So it's known as the Big Bang Theory. And for a lot of Christians, this is kind of like, I find like a lot of Christians and a lot of atheists don't understand the Big Bang Theory. A lot of Christians are very, they think the Big Bang Theory is something that undermines Christianity, and I've also met atheists who somehow think it's a great victory for the atheist view. The thing is, it's actually neither of those things. Because really, for most of the history of atheism, atheists have actually believed that the universe is self-existent, that the universe always existed, that it didn't come into being. And scientists in the modern era began to realize, but actually, if we look at the universe, it does seem to have a beginning. Everything is in motion, and therefore it had to have had a starting point. It had to have everything. The universe is expanding, but where did it expand from? And so there's this theory which the whole universe at one point, all matter, all energy, all particles and waves, everything in existence came from one single point. And there was this Big Bang, and everything came from that. Now, the problem with this, if you are a materialist, if you are an atheist, is that where does the Big Bang come from? You're back to Aristotle's question. What caused that? You have to have an uncaused cause for that. Because matter exists, and so how did it come into being? You know, the Big Bang Theory says everything, or at least the atheist view of the Big Bang is everything came from nothing, but how does nothing explode? And so that's the cosmological argument. Then The other famous one is the teleological argument, which is also known as the fine-tuning argument. And so that is that everything in the universe, the whole universe exists because of there are certain in physics there are certain constants. There are certain rules that the universe obeys. And these are all like set to a certain number, a certain degree. So things like the speed of light or gravitational constants or strong and weak nuclear forces, all of these things need to be perfectly calibrated and they need to fall within a very, very narrow range. And if they don't, the universe cannot sustain life. Not only can it not sustain life, even matter cannot even coalesce, cannot even exist, if these things aren't perfectly on the settings that they are supposed to be. It's like 100 dials have to be set exactly. And if any one of them is off by even a millionth of a degree, the whole universe could not exist. And it's a very powerful argument. I think it's one of the best arguments for the existence of a creator. Now, one of the pushbacks of that is, I don't know if you ever heard of the multiverse theory. If you've watched superhero movies, that's like the best thing since sliced cheese, because it meant they could just keep churning out more of the exact same. You know, they could just keep producing an infinite amount of Spider-Man because, you know, there's a multiverse. So, you know, there's different universes in which Spider-Man exists. But this was Stephen Hawking's pushback against the teleological argument, is that he was saying, well, it doesn't necessarily, just because this universe is perfectly, finely tuned to sustain life, doesn't mean there's necessarily a God, because there might be an infinite amount of universes. And we just happen to be in the universe that is able to sustain life. We just happen to be in that one universe out of the trillions of universes that exist that is able to sustain life. And you know, it's a smart idea, but there's also been pushback against that from philosophers, because it's not actually very plausible. It's not a very logical. It's a smart answer, but it's not plausible. Think about it this way. Imagine there was a guy who was he was sentenced to death by a firing squad, right? And we got the 100 best snipers on the planet, the 100 best marksmen, and we lined them up 5 meters away from this guy. And they were all, you know, and there was a countdown, 3, 2, 1, fire. And at just the right time, like at the moment when these 100 crack marksmen pulled the trigger, every single one of them flinched and missed him. Those 100 bullets went straight past him, and he stood there, and he is alive. And he is fine. Right. Now, there's two possible explanations we can give. The first explanation we could give is that, well, maybe it was just a big accident. Maybe all of them just by coincidence, had something going on at the same time that it's just all an accident. It's just a coincidence. Or the other explanation is something happened that caused them all to miss. Which is the more plausible explanation? Right? Obviously, it's the one something caused them to. It's possible that it could have been an accident, but is it plausible? It's not at all, and it requires so much more. If you think about it, like why? It's like it's possible that the universe is just a fluke, but is it reasonable to build your entire life on the 1 trillion chance that the universe happened by accident? It's not. All right. So, those are the traditional arguments for the existence of God. Now, do you find these arguments compelling? Some of you might say, that sounds pretty compelling. Some of you might feel, well, not really. I personally absolutely love philosophy. I love apologetics. You can probably tell that about me. This is the stuff that I love to geek out about. But the question I want to ask is, I'm actually not an apologist and I'm not a philosopher. I am a preacher. And I'm here to explain to you Romans chapter 1. And the question we need to actually ask is that what Paul's actually teaching? Is this Paul's argument for the existence of God? And here's the thing: if we could go back in time and we could speak to Paul and we were to ask him, how do we know that God exists? You know what I think Paul would say? I think Paul would say, you already know God exists. Every single human being knows God exists. We might not necessarily know that through rational argument, but we know instinctively, we know intuitively that God exists. We don't need proof. It's something you already know. There was one apologist who wrote a book. His name was John Blanchard, and he wrote a book called Does God Believe in Atheists? And I just love that title, because that's essentially the question. It's not about do atheists believe in God. It's like, we do. The question is there such a thing as an atheist? Because this is what Paul says. Look at verse 18. Why is God, what causes God's anger? Verse 18. The wrath of God is being revealed from heaven against all the godlessness and wickedness of men who suppress the truth by their wickedness, since what may be known about God is plain to them because God has made it plain to them. In verse 25, he says, they have exchanged the truth of God for a lie. Verse 21, he says, for although they knew God, they neither glorified him as God nor gave thanks to him. You see, you can't suppress something that you don't have. And because humans suppress the truth about God, that must mean that they have the truth of God. They know God exists. Every human being must already know there is a God, even if they won't admit it. Now, you might say, but hang on, like Paul doesn't see, that doesn't actually ring true with what we see around us in the world. You know, how on earth can that be true? Because, I mean, there are, if you look around the world, the vast majority of the world is very religious. You know, atheism is not the dominant viewpoint. It's actually dying at a tremendous rate. All of the major religions are just growing bigger and bigger and bigger year by year. The whole world's becoming more religious. So how can we say that, we by definition, deny or won't admit that that we truly have knowledge of God. Look at verse 25. They exchanged the truth of God for a lie and worshiped and served created things rather than the Creator. You see, we know about his power, we know about his divine nature. In other words, we know that he exists, and we also know something else about God. We know that he deserves worship. We know that we owe him worship. It's not that when we say, when Paul says that we suppress and deny the knowledge that we have from God, that the way in which we do that is not only through atheism. It's not only just saying, oh, no, I don't believe in God. It's not that mankind is intrinsically against religion. Mankind is intrinsically against true religion. Mankind has intrinsically set his heart against the God of the Bible. So Keller shared this illustration, and I thought that sort of explains this quite well. He said, imagine you have a father, and this father has, he has a family, there's a wife, he has a son, and another kid, and what in a tragic accident, his wife and their other child dies, and so he's left. It's just him and his boy, and his whole world now centers around this kid. This kid is the most important thing in his life. Everything, is the center of his universe. And they move to a new town, and they want to make a fresh start, and he enrolls his kid in the school, and 6 months later, the principal calls him into the office, and he says, listen, I need to talk to you about something quite serious. Johnny here, we've noticed that Johnny here is a thief, and here's the evidence. This has happened, this happened, this happened, you know, we thought we might be wrong, but it seems like the evidence is adding up that he's a thief. And of course, the father, who is, you know, immediately steps up and defends his son and says, no. You have got him completely wrong. And he presents arguments, reasons why that he is not a thief. It's like, no. It's just that particular teacher has a problem with him. He's actually really good, and they just, it's tall poppy syndrome. There are all these reasons why, you know, these things that you're bringing against him are not true. That's not who he really is. And eventually, you know, they insist, no, this is something you need to come to reckon with. And then the father gets so angry, he says, fine, I'm taking my kid out of the school. Puts him in a new school. Okay. 6 months later, that school principal calls him in and says, listen, we've discovered that your son is a thief. And again, the father develops a whole bunch of new theories as to why that cannot be true. And Zekeli uses this explanation to explain that's essentially what humans do with our knowledge of God. We don't want to acknowledge what we know. We don't want to acknowledge our knowledge of God because because it is so traumatizing. What we know about God is so traumatizing that we are unwilling to admit it. And so we come up with other theories. And so that might be, one, well, God doesn't exist. You know, Nathan and I often joke, we've got some friends that are sort of very strong atheists. And Nathan and I sometimes joke about them and say, well, if we would describe them, it's like, well, God doesn't exist, and I'm completely mad and angry that he doesn't, and I'm mad at him for not existing. And that's sort of one of the things. Like, we don't want to acknowledge that, and so we can say, oh, God doesn't exist. But another way we can avoid what we know about God is just to reinvent him. And that's why religion is so popular. Because I can just say, oh, well, yeah, I believe in God. I believe a God who is love and a God who just lets me live however I want to. And so, but at the base of both of those things is the same thing. Is that we don't want to recognize, we don't want to acknowledge what we actually know about God. As Paul says in verse 21, for although they knew God, they neither glorified him as God nor gave thanks to him. And that's essentially the definition of sin. It is where we know there is a creator on whom we depend and on whom everything we owe everything to, but we refuse to give him the glory. We refuse to acknowledge him. We refuse to worship him. Because what that would mean is that we would lose our independence. We would lose our sense that we get to make our own decisions. We get to live life our own way. And we get to... We lose control over our own lives. And that's essentially, that's the human problem. That's the heart of what sin is. And so you might come up with all sorts of theories and all sorts of reasons, what are ways to suppress the truth of God, because at the base of it, we want to live independently of him. Now, how can we truly know God? We choose not to know him. We choose to suppress the truth that we know God. But how do we truly actually know who he really is? Have any of you been to like a really amazing cathedral? Or just an incredible building? Yeah? Yeah? Where did you go, Tony? Oh, Westminster's incredible. Yeah. I went to Canterbury Cathedral. And it is magnificent. It is like a skyscraper before they had the technology to build skyscrapers. It is, you walk around Canterbury and you're like, where's the cathedral? I can't see it anywhere. And what you don't realize is that you have to look up to see the cathedral. It just goes up into the heavens. It is so huge. And it is mind-blowing. You just are struck with awe. And you know, when you walk into the cathedral and you see the beauty of it, you see the great stained glass windows, you see these arches, and you think, and you can learn a lot about the designer of this cathedral from just experiencing it. You can say, wow, the person who designed this, he was certainly smart. He was an absolute genius. I don't know how they built this without the use of, you know, hydraulics and scaffolding, and I don't know, like without the technology, he was an absolute genius who designed this place. He was someone who was with incredible creativity. He had an eye for beauty, and that's assuming it's a he. I don't know, maybe it was a she. But there's a lot you can tell from the building about the creativity, the ingenuity, the brilliance, the intelligence of the designer or the builder. But unless you've actually met the designer, you actually don't really know them. You can tell a lot about them to some extent, but there's also a lot that you can't know about them. And Paul says that's a little bit like what nature is like. If you look around creation, you know, the heavens declare the glory of God. The stars tell of his handiwork. If you look at nature, you can see his power, his greatness, his glory. There is something spiritual when you really get out into nature and you look at creation. It's moving, right? It tells us something about who God is. But there is something that's missing. If everything you believed about God came from what you saw in nature, what would be missing about your view of God? Yeah, and what's the basis of a personal relationship? Love. Exactly, love. Right? You can't go into creation, go into the world, the universe, and find, where can you see love? In the universe. I mean, you could say, well, look, I learned this horrible truth, you know, when we moved into a lifestyle block that's kind of infested with rabbits. And I thought, like, rabbits, come on, they're the fluffiest, cutest animals on the planet. They are like the epitome of love and tenderness and care, you know. And like, there's love, you know, the way that the mommy rabbit loves her baby rabbits. Until I learned this inconvenient truth. That, you know what happens with bunny rabbits? They look all cute, but in the middle of winter, the mommy rabbit realizes, oh, I have more babies than I can sustain. Like, I can't feed all of these babies. I will just kill a few of them. And she will just murder her own young. She'll kick them out of the burrow and let them die. Because, you know, don't want to feed them. It's not love. It's, you know, her care for her young is nothing but survival instinct. Nature is cruel and nature is merciless. And you know, some Kiwis will say, I can't believe in the God of the Bible because he's vengeful and he's full of anger and wrath. I believe in a God who is just a God of love. And I want to ask them, I'm like, where did you get that idea from? Where did you get it from? Because you can't find it in nature. You can't find it anywhere else. You say, you're complaining about the God of the Bible, and you say, oh, I like to believe in a God of love. The only place you can find a God of love is from the Bible. That's the only place you can get that idea that God ought to be loving. There was, you know, when there was an interesting essay that C.S. Lewis wrote, and it was in response to, like way before I was born, when the Russians sent the first cosmonaut into space. And his name was Yuri Gagarin. And apparently the Russian media said claimed that he said this, although I doubt it because he was actually a Orthodox Christian. But anyway, they claimed that Yuri went, when he went up into space in his space shuttle, that the words that he said was, I've been up into the heavens, I looked around, and I saw there was no God. And that was the soundbite that they sort of published, or the quote. And C.S. Lewis wrote a letter, sort of in response to this, an open letter, and he said, he explained that it's ridiculous if there is a God that exists. It's ridiculous that we would think that we could go somewhere in creation and find him there. And he said that would be like Hamlet in Shakespeare's play, Hamlet, but Hamlet's the character. And it would be like Hamlet walking around his world. Hey, are you Shakespeare? Are you Shakespeare? Are you Shakespeare? And you know, and then concluding, well, Shakespeare doesn't exist because I haven't met him. He's not in this world. So Lewis says, like, that's nonsense. Like, it doesn't make sense. Like, you cannot expect to find, to know who the author is and what he is like by looking at his creation. From his creation, from the perspective of a character within the creation, you can look around and you can say, clearly, this is designed. Clearly, there is an author. Clearly, there is a creator. But you cannot actually meet him. You cannot actually know him. Only insofar as the writer or the author would reveal himself to the characters in his book. Now, one of my favorite authors is a guy called J.R. Tolkien. And he wrote, sort of before, I don't know if many of you would know Lord of the Rings, it's very famous. But before he wrote Lord of the Rings, long before that, and this is, he wrote a book called Beren and Lúthien. And here's, I think I've got a picture of it. Yeah, there we go, there's Beren and Lúthien. And so he wrote that book long before any of his other works, and that was Tolkien's favorite book that he had written. It was the thing he loved and enjoyed the most out of all of the works that he had done. And it was this love story about Beren, this guy, and this elven maiden called Lúthien. And that sort of became the catalyst that started him writing all of his mythology and the whole story of Lord of the Rings and The Hobbit and Silmarillion and all of that stuff. And it all kind of came from this love story about Beren and Lúthien. And then something amazing happened when Tolkien's wife, Edith, passed away, something incredible happened. He put on her tombstone, so he wrote there, Edith Mary Tolkien, and then he wrote under her name, Luthien. And later, some years later, when he passed away, he had underneath his name was inscribed Baron. He was buried in the same grave as his wife. Now that does something amazing for fans of Tolkien, because most of us would never have ever met Tolkien. We've never met John Tolkien. We've never met Edith. We knew something of his brilliance as a writer, something of his creativity from his works, but we'd never met him. We didn't really know him. But when you read Beren and Luthien, what you realize is that you do know him. You know something really deep about who he is and what kind of person he is, because he wrote himself into the story. That whole story is about him and his wife. And so, here's the thing. This is essentially what the God of the Bible does. He created this world. He created this universe. He created us. But in Jesus Christ, he writes himself into the story. See, Paul says in verse 17, for in the gospel, a righteousness from God is revealed, a righteousness that is by faith from first to last. What the word righteousness means, so the gospel is the story of Jesus. It's that Jesus entered this universe as a human being, and he went and he died on the cross and he rose again. That's the gospel. And Paul says, in that gospel, a righteousness is revealed. And probably the fastest way I can explain what righteousness means is, as someone once told me, righteousness is right standing with God. It's coming into a relationship with God. Now there is a way through what the gospel shows us, what the gospel reveals to us, is that there is a way to know God truly, to be loved by God, to be in a relationship with him, and that comes by faith, from beginning to end, from first to last, faith and trust in Jesus. In the gospel, if you want to know what God is like, you can tell a little bit by looking at creation. You can tell something about who God is in creation. But if you really want to know him, he has written himself into the story. We can look at Jesus hanging on the cross, and we see God revealed in a way that we cannot see revealed in any other place. Because in the cross, what we see is God is so much holier. You can look at creation and say, wow, God's amazing. God is great. God is powerful. But we cannot get a sense for how holy he is, how absolutely morally perfect he is. That God is so much more holier than we thought. He is so holy that nothing short of the death of his own son would be enough to pay for our sin against him. That's what the gospel shows us. God is so much greater, so much holier than we ever thought. But also, the cross shows us that God is so loving that he willingly, voluntarily became a human being like us so that he could give up his life on the cross in our place. Because he loved us. And that's how you know who God is. That's how you know who he truly is and how you come into relationship with him. It is all revealed in the gospel of Jesus. And we can know him. We can enter into a relationship with him because Jesus, God, the second person of the Trinity, put on flesh so that we could know him. Let's pray. Our Father, we thank you that you are not hidden from us. Lord, you have made us in your image so that we can look into ourselves and we can see the very nature of God, the moral nature of God in our own consciences. We can look out into the universe and we can see its magnitude and its size and the brilliance of your creativity and your power and your divine nature. We can see all of that. But Lord, we thank you that you revealed far more than that to us. You revealed to us your special love for us when you took on flesh, became a man like us, and gave yourself up for us. Lord, I pray that we would come to know, that everyone here would come to know you as you really are in the person of Jesus. That we would all come, that we would acknowledge, Lord, in the many ways in which we suppress the truth. Even as Christians, Lord, we still struggle with that sinful nature, that desire to live life our own way and do things our own way, instead of giving thanks to you and giving the praise and the glory to you, we give them to other things. Lord, but help us to see the beauty of the story of the gospel. Help us to see your love for us in Jesus, so that we would then respond by giving our whole lives to you and living our whole lives as a sacrifice of worship to you. Amen.